Craig McCulloch will be speaking first, followed by Wade, and I've just got some bios to read out so we all know how impressive these gentlemen are. Craig is a senior consultant in Milliman's Australian practice. He joined the firm in 2011 and has recently been, amongst other things, working with financial advisor groups to help them improve their advice processes through the use of technology. In a previous life, Craig also spent 2 years working with financial advisors in the sales force of a UK insurance company and has spent large parts of his working life attempting to understand and communicate financial outcomes in the presence of uncertainty. Wade Madison. Wade is a principal and leader of Milliman's Australian practice. He joined the firm in 2004 and is responsible for the development, delivery and oversight of Milliman's Australian operations and across product development and retirement, as well as risk and capital management service lines. Wade has over 15 years actuarial experience in the life insurance and wealth management industries and has been involved in a variety of projects across the globe. Wade has also worked actively with clients in Asia, Europe and North America prior to establishing the Australian practice, was based in Milliman's London office. And hopefully the presentation's now good to go. Thank you.
OK, look, we'll try and run through this relatively quickly so we can all get to lunch as soon as possible. Thanks for the introduction, Brylan, and thanks everyone for coming along. Quick agenda for you. I'll give you a little bit of introduction and background and a little bit of discussion in a fairly stylized way of the sort of existing financial planning processes we've seen as we've gone through the work that we've done with financial planners, and then go on to just discuss the implications of that and some potential solutions of what we've seen. And then I'll hand over to Wade, who will talk about some, I guess, much more fluffy and less actuarial, but probably far more interesting things from here. So by way of background, the environment we've been in, I guess it's very different from an advice and a superannuation perspective than we've seen in the past. From our point of view, we've done a lot of work thinking about retirement and post-retirement, and that's just increasingly going to be the big driver of advice frameworks and where the industry is actually moving over the next decade and beyond. Now, on the back of that, we've observed, and a lot of the discussions we've had with financial advisors have borne this out, that there has been something of a crisis of confidence within the advice industry. The one, I think, really interesting example of this that I saw, which raised a lot of kind of ires and brought about a bit of gnashing of teeth, was you may remember just before Christmas, ASIC went public with, I think, a parliamentary committee where they brought out the results of a shadow shopper exercise they did, where they reviewed a number of financial plans and came to the conclusion that only 3% of those could actually be considered as good advice, as they were defining that. And I guess that brings about a couple of things from my point of view. One of the important things that came out of that was their comment that they saw far too much generic advice. And it's really how that advice is formulated and delivered that is, I guess, the topic that we want to touch on here. The other aspect of that, which I thought was very interesting, was the reaction of the financial advice community, which I think was generally quite defensive, but which is obviously to be expected, but very much focused on the very compliance-driven regime that I think a lot of advisors feel that they're under, which I think historically has certainly driven a lot of the frameworks that we currently see. And has led to some of the, I guess, less than optimal outcomes that we actually see within an advice framework. So along with that, obviously, we've got all of the environmental changes happening. Who knows quite how they will pan out? I don't pretend to have a crystal ball with any of that. FOFA is the one, I guess, which is interesting from our perspective and how that will actually change the way advice is actually presented and formulated for people. MySuper will have an impact, but I guess from an advice point of view, maybe less important. The other things which have been changing, which I guess are particularly relevant here, are the availability of different products, and certainly the Institute has been quite vocal in pushing the availability of things like longevity products and moving away from a kind of very pure accumulation type market that we currently have. And obviously we've seen an awful lot around technology and the way technology is changing pretty much every aspect of business already this morning. And I guess we're really jumping on the back of that. We've seen a lot of advances from our point of view in the way we deliver a lot of the institutional risk management for our clients in terms of things like distributed computing and the use of mobile technologies and all of those types of things as well. So on the back of that, we were engaged by a client of ours to use the skill set that I guess we think is a bit of an advantage of ours, which is around that institutional risk management frameworks and methodologies and a fairly strong technology background to look at evolving their financial planning framework. I'm not going to spend any time on these couple of slides. We've actually done quite a bit of research on this in the past. If people haven't picked up on any of that, there's some very good papers that the likes of Wade has written over the last few years. I guess just looking to rephrase and reformulate the way advice is given and think about things in a much more holistic way. Have a chat with either of us afterwards and we can point you in the direction of some of that. Good bedtime reading if you're struggling to get to sleep, I guess. What I did want to do is just to give you a very quick stylized overview of the sort of processes that we currently see in place around the way financial advice is actually provided in many instances. And this is simplistic, but I guess it's quite instructive in terms of thinking about the way advice is actually given. So typically a financial planning process will involve some kind of engagement process and then typically some kind of fact-finding or information gathering exercise, which will typically be broken down into I guess three main areas. One is understanding what customers are actually looking for, what they're actually trying to achieve. One is understanding what they actually have. And then the third part of that, which I guess is ensconced in this compliance-driven regime at the moment, is this notion of risk profiling. And that's very much the way that I guess investment-based advice is generally given at the moment. So typically what would happen there are that objectives are viewed. That might be an objective to provide income in retirement or to accumulate a certain amount of wealth. An advisor may typically then work out, okay, to achieve that type of objective, you might need to earn this amount of return from your assets. And then they'll combine that with that risk profile to essentially say, okay, given your appetite for typically investment risk, a portfolio which will provide you with that expected return may be too risky for you. So we might dial you down, or we might find that you're actually willing to take on more risk, so we might dial you up. And then some form of financial plan will be formulated around that with some kind of regular review process to actually look at how that actually pans out for the customer. Now, probably not worth stressing this too strongly, but generally for a group of actuaries, you look at that process and think, okay, that's a very simplistic deterministic process. It's very focused on one measure of risk for a customer, which is investment risk. Which is around how much volatility of assets or whatever that measure of investment risk we're actually going to use in that risk profile is there to determine outcomes and to base our decisions actually on. And the other thing that jumps out from that kind of process is that real separation of objectives and risk. And I guess one of the things that we've come across as we've done a lot of thinking on this is that those two things just really can't and shouldn't be separated. It makes much more sense to think of risk in an alternative way and to think in terms of objectives and customer risk to those objectives together in a much more holistic way. Now, I'm just going to give you a real simple example of some analysis we've done just to think about this and what it does. And hopefully this is just illustrative of the type of process we do see people moving towards and increasingly going forward. So, really simple case study where we have someone who's 10 years, say, from, or 5 years from retirement, earning a reasonable salary with just some generic super contributions, looking to retire with, in this case, a kind of fixed and in current dollar terms income from each year, has an existing super fund. In general, the numbers here aren't all that important, but also has some secondary things they actually want to achieve. For instance, to have a certain amount of wealth once they retire. Perhaps if they die, they want to have a certain amount of wealth that they want to leave behind as a bequest to family. They may want to have a certain amount of assets that they want to retain within liquid assets. Now, that existing process, if we go through it, it might give us an example typically like this, and this is the actual number from that example, that to meet that income goal, we need to actually earn something like 6.5% per annum to ensure that our income will last until some arbitrary age. which in this case we've chosen as age 90. So the process that we'd typically have gone through is that we would look at that, compare it to our risk profile, and then dial the amount of investment risk we might actually take up or down. If we find that under that particular set of assumptions there aren't enough, there isn't enough risk to be taken, then we might change that investment goal. We might say, okay, we'll dial down the amount of income we have to make something more sustainable, or potentially just accept the fact that we're not going to be able to sustain our retirement income through to retirement. But I guess from an actuarial point of view, the obvious question that leads to is, okay, well, what actually are the chances of being able to sustain those types of goals once we think about those types of assumptions? So what we've done is we've run some stochastic simulations. We've run something like 10,000 simulations and essentially tried to assess the likelihood of actually meeting some of those goals at different ages. Now, you'll be familiar with all this sort of analysis. I guess the particular outcomes here are for three different types of investment strategies. So first strategy is just a typical kind of default strategy. A second strategy is one where potentially we look to dial down an amount of investment risk to take us back to that 6.5% expected return. And then the third strategy, is for illustration here, is just one where I've assumed we use some sort of annuity strategy to invest a large chunk of the assets to provide more certainty of income. And the point about doing that is we can then think about that at different points in time and think through, okay, relative to these objectives, how likely are we to actually meet some of these goals? And obviously by age 75, which is relatively short over this time period, there's actually a pretty good chance under all of these strategies of meeting the types of goals we want. Obviously, where we have the annuity-based strategy, then that liquidity outcome disappears as some of that liquidity is given up. In this example, I've assumed some fairly hypothetical life annuities, which I know not many people actually use. But it's illustrative of the type of thing that can actually be done to change some of these outcomes. Now, the point about all of this is not that we're, I guess, looking to predetermine or judge what actually is the best outcome. This is all about process and about saying, okay, how well does that existing process actually stack up? And one of the interesting things is when we then think about this at age 90, how these numbers actually change. And I guess the really interesting thing on these charts, and the furthest out points here are 100% likelihood of actually being able to achieve those goals. And the closer we get on each of those scales to the centre, we're actually completely unlikely to meet those goals. Is that for that second strategy, which might be the situation you might end up with for a typical risk-averse investor who's looking to earn that 6.5% return, we've actually got something like a 1 in 2 chance of actually failing to meet that objective by age 90, which is, I guess, a fairly perverse way of thinking of what actually might happen for that investor when ultimately it should be those objectives which are actually driving the strategy and the risk of actually being able to achieve those for that particular investor. And in actual fact, broadly speaking, the likes of that first strategy in this particular example generally gives actually better outcomes in almost all of those goals, particularly that primary income goal, when in actual fact, simply because of that investment view of the world and that constraint that's put on from that investment process, we actually end up with something which is probably less than optimal in that particular case for the particular client. Now, all of this is, I guess, framed in terms of investment risk. But the point about a framework like this, where we're very much concentrating on objectives, how likely are we to actually meet those goals, is that you don't really need to think purely in terms of investment constraints and to do this. So one interesting thing I did here was actually look at an alternative variation on, in this case, the first strategy, which was a default-type investment fund, but where we'd taken some very typical actions that we might take through a financial plan. So, for instance, increase the amount of savings we've taken or carry out some kind of tax advantageous method like performing a transition to retirement. And the point is, once you incorporate those types of elements within a framework like this, then we can start to come to much more optimal decisions in terms of the genuine risk to the investor of actually meeting some of those objectives. So really just to summarise kind of where we are at the moment versus, I guess, something that we can certainly improve on, I would certainly argue that those existing processes are very goal aspirational rather than objective driven. It's quite interesting because one of the key bits of feedback that we've actually received from advisors through going through some of this process is that there is a real genuine intention to meet objectives for the clients. But I guess some of those processes are actually failing just in terms of being able to actually deliver some of that. And that is probably partially due to the environment we've come from, where thinking of things purely in terms of investment risk is very much an accumulation way of thinking of the world and not all that well suited to a world where goals are much more based on income and drawdown and the types of things that might happen for investors post-retirement. So obviously that leads us to the conclusion that those existing tool sets are just too simplistic to actually provide some of that advice. We want to merge some of that risk profiling with those objectives. And the obvious solution to that is to go down the route of the type of analysis we've just produced here. So essentially to think of a kind of personal actuarial model where we run that kind of modelling for individuals to look at outcomes, look at how likely we actually are to meet some of those objectives, and then base the advice process and how we tweak that advice and, I guess, have the discussion with individual clients around risk in terms of phrasing it as risk to objectives rather than some fairly arbitrary definition of investment risk, which admittedly we could still incorporate into that. Now, through this, obviously, I actually produced this slide and then realised that when I said we're not all actuaries / rocket scientists, we probably actually are all actuaries or rocket scientists in this room. But the point is that financial advisors and their clients aren't. So discussing things in terms of stochastic asset modelling and producing probabilities of actually being able to meet your objectives and so on may not be a language or a way of phrasing this type of advice which is actually well suited to individuals. I guess behavioural science has a lot to add here in terms of explaining that individuals just do not make decisions based on purely rational numerics of what they're actually going to experience. Often those decisions are subjective and are based on individual biases and preferences. And clearly those things aren't static. People's priorities will change, they will have different objectives and their life situation will change. So, on the back of that, I'll hand over to Wade to just discuss how we've actually gone about reviewing some of those problems and actually looking at alternative ways we can actually deal with some of that.
Great. Thanks, Craig. So as Craig aptly described at the outset, onto the fluffy stuff. So I apologise in advance for the lack of any numbers, but essentially, you know, we went through this process and you know, not only internally but externally, as we've had conversations with clients and a number of you guys in the room, you know, and there have been other papers that people have written over the years about these sorts of issues. I think as actuaries we appreciate that there are, you know, there are better ways of doing what the advice industry has done. And it inevitably kind of comes back to that modelling problem in a sense. But I think where the rubber really hits the road on some of this stuff, and I guess the approach we started to, as we worked down this path, is started to actually sit down with advisors and understand, well, how do they function, I guess, to, you know, to try and get beyond the absolute that there's a modelling answer here. Because the reality, as Craig mentioned earlier, is that, you know, priorities change over time, people's circumstances change, and that advice framework's very much a variable thing that we're trying to deal with. So in the context of the way we went about it, we went through a process in conjunction actually with a digital agency where we sat down to try and understand the design elements, the kind of the, you know, what they call contextual inquiries, where you actually sat down with advisors, understood, well, what did they do day to day, and go through that with a number of advisors, because every advisor is also different. Try and understand what process they work through, what sort of tools they use, what client goals they were focused on, what their client base looked like, what workarounds or kind of tricks of the trade they utilised in their day-to-day roles. And I guess it's fair to say it was wide-ranging and quite varied. And so from that perspective, it wasn't a case of getting advisors to come to us and then running a workshop. We actually went to them, sat down in their office at their desk almost as a, you know, kind of a, you know, default client to get them to walk through and understand exactly what their environment was like and how they functioned. And then that led us to some conceptual designs and I guess trying to reinforce and challenge some of the preconceived ideas that we had. So I think it was really interesting, as you go through this sort of process, then inevitably a whole bunch of assumptions that you make up front get validated. So in terms of our perspective, I think, you know, some of the really interesting stuff was that, you know, rather than sort of assume that you know, the process may be flawed, but advisors inevitably are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to solve that problem for their clients. So that was kind of, you know, a very important foundation. The end game or the kind of the ultimate result we're trying to get to is the same. That advisors are really in a position of trust, so they're trying to work with their clients and instill trust with their clients. They're not looking for a silver bullet. They're not looking for something to churn out a magic number that they can say, well, the system says this is the number, so it must be right. It's very much a faith-based relationship. So how do they, you know, firstly earn that trust and then how do they retain it going forwards? Having said that, there were tools that they accepted could help improve the robustness of the advice that they gave. So I think they generally accepted that the existing things they utilised didn't necessarily deal with uncertainty and the whole number of parameters that are thrown into this very complicated mix of sort of solution, you know, meets problem type approach. And many of them did actually accept that the existing process was flawed in many respects. So, again, we went through this at an advisor conference and one of the sort of the owners of the dealer group was asking their advisors how many of them sort of worked around the existing compliance process, and unanimously their hands went up. So they understand the process is flawed and they try and find workarounds to get to what they believe is the right outcome. And it wouldn't be a process unless it also challenged some of the assumptions that we had. So I think, you know, and as sort of, I guess, you know, jumping to solution mode, I think it was a reality check to try and step back a little bit from that and understand how you can take advisors on that ride with you. You know, it's a lengthy journey to solve this problem. So these are some of the themes that came out of that. So obviously, you know, start from the world they inhabit, and then try and, you know, nudge them along, try and enhance the process they use rather than reinvent it. You know, try and find a solution that will encourage them to take it up. You know, keep trying to connect to their goals over time rather than simply give them a gimmick that they can then introduce to a client and then move on to the just continuing to operate as normal. So how do you then integrate that with their process? And I think fundamentally as well that clients don't necessarily make a decision there and then. So many clients sit down. A lot of these decisions are have long-term impacts. They're substantial financial decisions. They digest a lot of information and then they go away and they may test it with their families, with their peers they respect and so on, and then come to some decision. So it was important to give them enough information that they go away, have those sorts of conversations and potentially give them something that they could digest as well. So in terms of then looking at, you know, how advisors operated in that sense, how their engagement with their clients worked, then, you know, it was very much, like I said, a trusted relationship. So they're really focused in that upper tier, you know, around sort of, you know, clarity, wisdom. These sorts of words kept coming about when we talked to advisors. You know, so it's kind of, it's interesting, as you get into how that profession operates, it's, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, like an iceberg in a sense that they're focusing on the top tier, which is really the key elements that their clients are focused on. How do you give me comfort? How do you win my faith? But then underneath the surface, there's a huge amount of activity that goes on. And you talk to any financial advisor in terms of what they need to do around compliance and the planning and, you know, tools and systems. So there's a whole range of things underneath the surface there that the client never necessarily sees but is actually going on to try and formulate into an advice program. And then these are just some of the comments, I guess, that reinforce this as we talk to advisors. So this is coming from advisors' mouths themselves. So things like they demystify financial jargon. The value proposition isn't about market returns. It's actually not taking responsibility for that, but trying to influence the way people behave. So interesting insight into how they view their role. I think as Craig mentioned, the process itself is, I guess, how that tends to operate is sort of fairly straightforward. I guess when you overlay on top of that what they're trying to do around gathering that faith or trust, then it's very much understanding the goals and making connection with someone up front, working that through into a more detailed assessment phase, and then finally coming up with a statement of advice, and then an appropriate implementation path. So again, some of the comments there were raising issues to cover later. So again, you're dealing with very sophisticated things. You can't do it all in one meeting. So how do you then extrapolate that and gradually take your clients on that journey with you? In terms of trying to understand the flaws or the issues they had with the existing process, we sort of went through those aspects. And I guess, the first, to the top line item that you see there, is really compliance. So they appreciate they need to try and find ways to do things better, but you inevitably have this compliance burden that sits behind you and trying to sort of dovetail the two together. So if you think about how advisors give advice at the moment, then typically someone goes in, they go through some risk profiling process, which spits out an answer, someone's moderately aggressive or balanced investor, and then lo and behold, there's a balanced fund or a moderately aggressive type investment strategy that you then end up. So you end up this one-to-one match. It's very easy from a compliance perspective. As you start to introduce some of these broader concepts around how do we dynamically change things, how do we kind of focus more on the goals or the objectives, then as you work back from that, you end up with investment strategies or products that don't necessarily fit a neat compliance regime, because everyone's goals and the way they prioritise those goals is very different. And so the investment solution or the product solutions that are going to fulfil that are going to be different. So, whilst I'd hope we all agree that we need to start this goals-based sort of approach, then the problem with that is then in essentially dovetailing it with the compliance regime we operate in and trying to find ways to try and facilitate both those things. So how do they do that? Better communication and risk, I think that's a no-brainer. I think risk is now becoming more and more prevalent simply because their clients are changing. Their risk is more relevant to a lot of advisors' clients that are approaching retirement, entering retirement, plus market volatility and so on is becoming a larger issue. And I think, dovetailing with some of the regulatory change, where the advice industry itself is going is sort of struggling with this opt-in and all those sorts of regulatory issues as well. How do they continue to justify advice? And as part of that justification of advice is getting the client to co-own the strategy. So to take a vested interest to own the strategy and then work with the advisor in true partnership to tweak and update it over time. So the comment I think is really insightful there to see that advisors, in their own words, do a lot of rear vision stuff, and they want to focus more and more on the future, the future, how they kind of help their clients meet their goals in a forward-looking manner. In terms of technology, I'll very quickly through this, really interesting landscape. They use lots of different things, basically. They use what fits with their personal style. They use a mixture of their own tools they've developed. They use tools the dealer group or the institutions that own them essentially sort of either mandate or stipulate. In terms of engaging with clients, some of them don't use any systems. They sit down, they have a conversation, write notes on paper, and then go and do detailed analysis a few days later in the back room. Some have got electronic whiteboards. So you find they're very different styles across a whole range of advisors, so trying to come up with something that's going to fit them or help them move along needs to take that into consideration, that they all operate in very different ways and yet still have some of the same issues and same flaws. So, and even though some of the large systems that they tend to use don't necessarily do everything they need to, don't let them focus on strategic advice. They may be more compliance-driven, those sorts of things. And then ultimately their time is precious, so we found data entry is going to be an issue. And I'm not necessarily certain how you're going to solve that, but finding ways to enter data in one sort of source of truth rather than have to populate multiple systems. In terms of areas of improvement, things like branding came up. Obviously they want to own and be able to promote themselves and use anything they have as sort of an enhancement to their service offering. Obviously minimise data entry, I mentioned. And in terms of better assets to give to clients, I think that's really about, as I said, clients make decisions outside that meeting. So giving them more sophisticated or better takeaways where the client can sit down there, ponder it, discuss it with their peers and so on, and help reinforce their decision outside of the environment where they're sitting across the desk from the advisor is also an important aspect. In terms of contextualising that, then we went through some basic design elements. There's a lot more detail, but I guess this is sort of the initial, some of the initial types of things we considered. And I guess the focus out of a lot of those conversations were advisors really lacking something that they thought could address some of the strategic concerns, the ability to sort of enhance the strategic advice they wanted to give, and at the same time engage with clients up front. So as far as we started sketching out these, and there's more detailed work that's been done that's not in this slide pack, but I thought this is a good taster. It was really about having something that could engage with a client. So client, using those words like ownership, trust, faith, partnership, where they could sit down with a client and then the client could actually start to engage through an interface, and then you get back into detailed analysis down the track. So it was really going through paths like, well, talking to the client in terms of where are they at their stage of life, bringing up issues around the goals, and starting to have sort of tidbits or little conversation starters where an advisor could sort of bring up a financial fact and engage in a conversation with the client, start to bring things like a long-term financial goal back to a short-term behavioural aspect to try and then engage the client and have a deeper discussion, and that would lead into some of the more detailed types of analysis that Craig highlighted in his slides. And so in terms of sort of summarising, I guess, if you take the process that was very linear that we outlined at the very start, and then you start from this goals-based oriented approach, and really, funnily enough, for actuaries, we end up with a cyclical type of approach where we start with goals, we work our way around, and then you end up coming back to where you started, because inevitably, someone's goals will change or their circumstances will never be changed, and that's sort of the trigger to reassess, tweak, fine-tune the strategy, or make quite significant changes potentially if the changes to the objectives are dramatic enough. And so we don't necessarily see it as being a system that provides you with an absolute answer. I think it's a tool. These sorts of tools will inevitably be developed to help communicate the complexity around the decisions the advisor's making. It'll be able to take into account a broader range of product solutions. So things like the debates on annuities that we see constantly kicking around will start to be diminished through these types of frameworks, because if someone's goal is to have a guaranteed income stream to meet day-to-day living expenses, then why isn't an annuity part of the solution there? And so without those sorts of kind of goals-oriented programs, then we'll end up with sort of this diverse product range. But I think as we start to look at these in a slight, these sorts of approaches slightly differently, then we'll find the products that we've developed have a better fit or better use and integration with clients long term. I'm just aware that we still want some time for questions, but I think this is pretty straightforward. Obviously, we're looking to try and find ways to give clients and their advisors greater ownership and ability to understand the implications of some of their behaviours and the strategic advice they receive. Trying to get more to an outcome-oriented solution rather than what we'd characterise as sort of an approximation through this risk profiling concept. Look at the risk to achieving those outcomes rather than kind of the journey along the way where people may knee-jerk and react in an adverse manner to short-term financial changes. Foster greater ownership to clients, obviously, and then allow for the emerging complexity and sophistication, the product markets that we're going to see. In terms of challenges, as I said up front, then, you know, the compliance, sort of the nature of compliance in the industry is a real, I guess, barrier in a sense, in terms of how do we integrate more flexible, goals-based, highly individualised type advice process into that compliance regime. Communications understandings, simply communicate, do you actually tell someone they've got a 50% chance of meeting a goal? What does that mean? Do they even understand it? So how do we start to introduce these sort of probabilistic concepts to people? Fitting within the advice process as it works without adding sufficient time, effort, and requirements to the advisors and the technology, ultimately. Craig's already mentioned some of these, but I guess we believe, the existing advice process is trying to target the same objective that we think these processes will. Essentially we see opportunities for smarter tools and essentially think that, the actuarial community, given its skill set, is naturally placed to help develop some of these options. So with that, happy to take some questions.
David Morris. One of the challenges you didn't put up there, which I think is a very practical one, is one of cost, because one, people don't seek advice, and two, they won't pay for it. Having gone through a similar exercise and been charged $3,000 or $4,000 for paying up front, I just can't see, it's a wonderful model, but I can't see how you're going to solve the biggest challenge, which is affordability.
I'd maybe try and turn that a little bit on its head and ask, are people not prepared to pay for it because they simply don't see the value? And so, I think one of the things that's really been a wake-up call to the industry is actually the financial turmoil that we've seen, because if you consider sort of the 10 years prior to that, then advisors were able to, maybe sit back and kind of say, well, look, everything's going swimmingly because you've done really well in terms of your investment returns. There's no issues. But now with regulatory reform, changes to the remuneration structure that advisors see through rebates and so on, then I think they're starting to get back to how do they justify that value? How do we actually justify to people that the advice they give is worthwhile? And so I see sort of greater sophistication in the tools they use, in the analytics that they have at their disposal, as actually being a facilitator to justify to their clients that the advice they're giving is a bit more sophisticated and therefore potentially worth the money. But I think it's a multi-dimensional question that's difficult to answer in a couple of seconds. But I think there's things like scaled advice and the balance between holistic and the sort of abbreviated advice models that'll also help to address that over time.
And there's one point I guess I just want to touch on there, which I guess feeds on from some of what we've already heard today, but a part of this is about better engaging with customers and clients and explaining that value. I guess one of the benefits of a lot of the technology that has already been discussed this morning and that I guess we've been a part of is that we can use these types of tools to do that. So whether that's actually something which can carry on from beyond just a kind of very point of advice piece of engagement that happens once a year to something which is more ongoing and makes better use of technology and kind of provides a much stronger link between advisors and the clients and the advice that they're actually providing there. That's an area where I do see this type of work can take us. And some of the technology that's available there to help kind of deliver that is really there already to help actually enhance and kind of make that value proposition between an advisor and the client that much stronger than it might actually be.
Anthony Ash from University of New South Wales. Question really as a researcher as much as anything else. It seems to me that sort of the unknown unknowns, is an incredibly unscientific industry. The question is if I give this advice, what will happen and how will people feel afterwards? But no one really seems to ask the question, how do people feel afterwards? So, you know, it's a sort of question of how do you best cope with retrenchment? Who copes best with retrenchment? Do you go back to work or do you start, or do you decide to cut your is it better to cut your expenses to your reduced income? How much cover do you need? Should you be taking risks in investment? Should it be downsizing? Should you be moving into an old age home? All these are really questions that are empirical questions because we can actually ask people and there's a little bit of research done. It's not done, and these advisors are frankly, I mean, they're shooting into, they're setting goals that they don't, it doesn't seem to me that we really have any good idea of what's going on. So my thing is there a need for, if you agree there's a need for research, how can we actually push it ahead? Because there's lots of information out there, but it's very difficult to collect.
I guess I'm not sure I'm quite in a position to answer the question I did understand the question correctly. I guess you're right. These are very empirical questions, and I would argue that the advice community, as it currently stands, deals with those issues every day, day in, day out. I guess what we're trying to do here is to try and help produce something which is a bit more living and breathing and moves through those circumstances. So that, you know, advisors can regularly have those discussions with their clients as those circumstances change and adapt, and have those conversations that say, okay, I'm now in a different position to the position I was previously in because of whatever that life circumstance actually was, and therefore I need to reset where I am or rethink those objectives. I have no feeling, I guess this is a question for you in the academic community as to what research actually looks like in that instance, because you're really in the realms there of how do people behave when circumstances change, and how should they behave as circumstances change. I would certainly hope that this type of work is all about helping to put more meat on the bones of those reactions as those circumstances change, rather than necessarily fumbling about in the dark.
I guess I'll just add to that you know, we talk about this at a lot of conferences over and over, which is it's about education, and then ironically sort of the education that comes about doesn't kind of delve into the issues in greater detail. So I think there's education of just the general public, you know, and how can they better understand some of the issues that they face, and how do we kind of balance that natural tendency for people to focus short term when they should be thinking potentially longer term? That's just innate human behaviour. And then there's education of advisors. So, you know, there are people in this room that are probably better qualified to talk about the diversity of advisors in the industry, but I think you've got a very broad brush there of capabilities and skills just within the advice community itself. So how do we bring up the skill level of the advisors at one end of the spectrum and enhance the quality of advice at the other? So.
G'day, Richard Starkey here. Thanks for the presentation. That was really good, and I could really relate to some of the issues you came across, particularly with communicating to clients, helping advisors communicate. I just didn't quite get what you were aiming at. Are you trying to come up with a new bit of software, or are you trying to come up with a new process? What happens next?
There's probably a couple of things there. You know, if you just think of it as a tool, then I guess it's fair to say that, so the use of an actuarial tool or a simulation, stochastic type tool within that advice framework
can add a lot more value to advisors. But I guess the pure reality is that if you built it and tried to sell it tomorrow, then you know, no one would pick it up. You know, it's a little bit like the advice model. You have to, you know, advisors actually have to accept and buy in to the need, you know, and the rationale that the process that they currently had is flawed in some way. And look, some advisors do understand that, and some don't. So I think, you know, I think there's a space for those tools, but inevitably it's actually about working with the advice community and trying to, you know, I guess essentially educate them and try and find ways to enhance the advice that they give to their clients and the understanding they have, you know, for the products and strategies, and giving them the tools ultimately to help them deliver that advice in confidence to their clients.
Martin Olk here. Thank you for that. Those conclusions are certainly consistent with my experience of a range of financial advisors, although I accept that's a bit of a subset. Three comments, one question. Firstly, identification of the goals. I think where I've seen more success is whether the advisors understand the values, the motivations, the drivers behind the goals. So I think that helps with the priorities. I think it helps address Anthony's concern. Second, in terms of the forward-looking rather than the backward-looking, the ongoing nature, I'm keen to ban the term review meeting because it almost defines we're just going to look at the performance over the last 12 months. So I expect, you know, advice I work with use terms like progress meeting, which implies a continued look at the goals, changes in circumstances, what do we need to change, or a planning meeting, right, what are the plans going forward. Third, no doubt, visuals help. So the idea of how using, for example, a mind map to put the lifestyle, the plan on a single page, clients love that. So my question, in terms of the advisors you work with, are the visuals that you saw that were successful in communicating some of those issues to the clients?
Yeah, look, that's right. There's kind of another point to that. We're talking to one group and said, make it fun. So I'm not sure how you kind of marry all those things up. But I think it's a really interesting area because you're trying to balance that engagement piece with what's ultimately a complex concept. And so I think the tools that they tended to focus on really started from simplistic origins. So they would start with the concepts at a very high level and then kind of evolve into a more detailed discussion. So, you know, so things like, you know, so if you take the chart that Craig showed in the first few slides where you've got sort of this sort of diamond diagram, you would never virtually start with something like that because the sort of the debate, the discussion around the information that gives you is too detailed. So you're almost starting with very high-level illustrations that would say, you know, almost like a thermometer, for instance, to say, well, around your income objective, you know, are you too hot on this and you're not going to get there, or is it nice and cool? So it's kind of taking everyday things people can relate to because you're ultimately communicating to the public and then stepping back at a sort of high level and then allowing advisors to then, if they choose to, go down to the next level of detail and then have that discussion. In terms of what they currently use, you know, like, it's pretty varied, and I guess some of them like what, you know, they kind of like what they use, although they're using what they believe is sort of the best of breed. But I guess the overriding comment there is that it could be better. So I think there's huge room for improvement, and that's where I think there's significant opportunity to try and help advisors have better tools at their disposal.
Yeah, one of the interesting things from some of those sessions we actually ran with advisors is that lots of different advisors had different ways of communicating exactly the same topic. And a number of them would get up with a whiteboard and sketch out all manner of lines and charts and graphs. And the researcher that we were working with would take photographs of those and, you know, summarise those up. And you'd look at the photographs and go, I have no idea what on earth is actually up there. It's just a spaghetti mess of illustration. So there's no doubt there's been a big room for improvement there. And I mean, I touched on it earlier as well. Your point around progress meetings and planning meetings. There's some really interesting things that can be done there, and I suspect this is a while away yet. But in terms of thinking about, okay, how do we have that ongoing conversation with individuals? You know, the thermometer idea. How am I going against my goals? Well, why can't I log onto my iPhone and press the app for this and say, okay, you know, given where my assets are currently sitting, I'm underwater this week relative to last week or whenever I set my plan. And how can you bring about engagement ideas and ways in which value between advisors and clients can be added from that? So there's lots of room to maneuver in that space from a purely from a technology point of view.
I think we might call it to an end, so we're going to go off to lunch. Do you want to join me in thanking Wade?